in all the addresses that I'll make over the next few weeks, it's not my intention to deal with anything really profound and difficult to understand. I just want to deal with some things that are very straightforward, things perhaps that have lodged in Christian minds down through the ages, things that are very, very familiar to us, and things that really give us encouragement and comfort in the situations in which we find ourselves. I think it's true to say, isn't it, that here are verses that are great encouragement to us, especially when you think, you know, if I was to suggest to you, you know, the throne of grace that is mentioned in these particular verses, it's something that automatically resonates in the heart and mind of Christians as we consider what this aspect of the throne of grace means to us. It's something that's built into and burnt into the psyche of all Christians. I think you can go anywhere perhaps in the world and ask people, you know, about the throne of grace and what it means to them, and the automatic response would be is that it would drive them back to think of God as one who is seated upon that eternal throne, and yet that throne is described here as being the throne of grace. It's one of those things that stimulates and encourages us to realize something of the wonder and amazement of what we are before God and what God has done for us in Christ. Unlike the world at large, of course, we believe in a God who is the living God. People of the world think that perhaps we think of God as in a fable sense of a way, or something of a figment of our imagination, something that we hope is there but isn't there in reality. But yet, for the Christian themselves, we know that what we look at and we consider, when we consider the throne of grace, we are reminded automatically of the one who is sitting upon that throne. And God presents himself to us in a very real and glorious way. And in many ways, when you read these particular verses, there is this tremendous encouragement, because what the writer wants to do is he wants to present us and show to us something of the glory of the one who is there at this moment of time in the presence of God on your behalf and my behalf. There's something so stimulating, so encouraging to realize that the writer wants to present us with the person of Jesus. I think if you read through the whole of this book of Hebrews, what you find is that Jesus is presented to us time and time again. He is exalted and lifted up and magnified before us. And as I preached recently on Hebrews chapter 1, you know, the significance of Jesus being far, far superior to all the angelic hosts. The angelic hosts come, and God has said to them that they are to worship him, to bow down before him, to recognize in Jesus who he really is, that he is the eternal Son of God. He is the one who is precious to God himself. And God himself has declared Jesus to be very, very special, unique, and far, far superior, even to the angelic hosts who live and dwell in the presence of God. It's amazing, isn't it, for us to consider that, the uniqueness of who Jesus is. And this is what the writer is trying to present to us time and time again throughout this letter. And in many ways, what you find here in these verses is a picture of Jesus as portrayed to us as our great high priest. It reminds us of his role. It tells us what he does, how he functions. It also describes to us the very nature and character of who Jesus is, that he is not only our great high priest, but he is a priest who is sympathetic to our situation. So we have one who is there at this moment of time, who is high and elevated and exalted, and yet one who is sympathetic to those who are below him, those who have entered into a wonderful relationship with him, where Christ becomes our Savior. And this is what is presented to us. The writer wants us to focus our minds, our thoughts, our desires, consider him in every aspect of who Jesus is, to realize the wonder and the amazement of the condescension of Jesus being unique in every way. And the reason why he is unique as our great high priest, and what makes him far, far superior to all other high priests that have ever gone before him, is the fact that he is the Son of God. The fact is that he's not just an appointment by men to this particular role, but he is one who has been set aside. He is one who has been exalted in this particular role. He is our great high priest, and he is described as Jesus, which is a description of his humanity. The fact that his name shall be called Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sin. This is the name that was given to him in the incarnation when he came into this world. But then you look a little further and you can see that what makes him so unique is the fact that he is the Son of God. The fact that he is one who lived and dwelt with God before he ever came into the world. And when he came into the world, of course, he took upon himself this particular role that he would be our great high priest. And then when you consider the picture that is presented to us in the Old Testament about the high priests there, they had basically two particular roles to fulfill. One was that they offered sacrifices on behalf of the people, which you can read about in chapter 5. But also on top of that, they made intercession for the people. Those were the two roles wrapped up in the one, as it were. Those are the two functions that he performs. And he performed in the Old Testament as a priest, but now in the New Testament, of course, we have Jesus, who is being presented to us as far superior to all the priests and high priests that ever came before him. And so when we look at who Jesus is, what we do is we see this one unique in every way when we consider him. And we see him as that great priest. The sense of the glory of who Jesus is, it's spoken about him in this superlative sense. They want to lift up and exalt Jesus beyond anybody. There is no comparison between any of the priests that ever came before him. And so Jesus, when he is presented to us, he is presented to us in this particular way, that he is shown to be the eternal Son of God, but he is shown to be the one who has done something for us that no other person could have ever done before or since. He is the one who has reconciled us back to God. He is the one that we read about here, and it's a description given to us about what Jesus achieves in his death and in his resurrection. The fact that he has now ascended back into the presence of God. And if you're wondering where the ascension comes in, it tells us, isn't it, that Jesus is the one who has passed through the heavens. He has gone into the very presence of God at this moment of time on our behalf. The Old Testament picture that you had, of course, was that you had the temple, as Mark has been mentioning recently, and you had this huge veil that was there that was to separate man from God. Basically, man could not approach God. Why? Because God was in heaven. The curtains themselves, the veil, was sewn with various characters on it, the angelic and cherubims, angelic beings and cherubims. They were all portrayed there. It was the picture of heaven itself. Beyond this veil, this was where God was. And we know that God, at this moment of time, is there in heaven. He is in that glorious place, which is separated from the world. And yet Jesus, we read about, he is the one who has passed through the heavens. When you see and read the account in Acts chapter 1 concerning him speaking with his apostles, what you find is that as the apostles were speaking to him, it just tells us simply that Jesus ascended before them, and a cloud received him out of their sight, and suddenly two angelic beings appear, and they are telling us about where Jesus has gone. The same Jesus whom you will see ascending into heaven will come in like fashion as you see him ascend. There is something glorious about this, isn't it? The fact that Jesus simply was elevated from the world and suddenly is taken out of their sight and into heaven and into glory itself. He has now gone into the very presence of God. And all of these things are portrayed to us here in this book of Hebrews. We get the picture of Jesus fulfilling his role as our high priest, doing something that no other could do. He is the one that we read about, that because he is our high priest, he continues as a priest for us on our behalf. One of the things that when I was in Bible college and we had to study Greek and things, you know. One of the things that always stuck in my mind was that one of the lecturers used to say, oh, this is a punctilia, he used to say to us. And I said, oh, right, okay, it's a punctilia, right, great. And then he said, well, this is a linea, you know. And I said, oh, right, great, I'll take this in as well, you know. And as I would be considering these things, you know, the whole point of a punctilia and linea is the fact that punctilia is basically a full stop, and the linear is a line, right? So you've got that, didn't you? That's the first Greek lesson I'm giving you tonight. So you have this sort of picture of Jesus as our high priest. What does he do? As our high priest, he offers himself as a sacrifice for our sin. This is punctilia. There's one point in time and in history where that was fulfilled. And Jesus does this on our behalf. He died for our sins upon the cross of Calvary. In chapter 10 of the book of Hebrews, what you read here is that in verse 11, it tells us like this, and every priest stands ministering daily and offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of God, from that time waiting till his enemies are made his footstool. For by one offering, he has perfected forever those were being sanctified. Jesus himself, by this very one act, by this one sacrifice, this one offering that he made in offering up himself as a sacrifice for our sin, fulfilled all of what God demanded. He made a sacrifice for you and for me as sinners in the sight of God. But his role as our great high priest doesn't terminate simply at Calvary. That was one aspect of his ministry. In chapter 5 here, you can read about Jesus in verse 5, for example. He says like this of him, so also Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest, but it was he who said to him, you are my son, today I have begotten you. As he also says in another place, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. So you see the linear there. He is a priest forever. We read about him that he ever lives to make intercession for us. He is somebody who is there praying on our behalf at this moment of time. He is our representative, our advocate in the very presence of God. He pleads our cause, your cause, my cause, in the very presence of God himself. And this is a picture here that he has passed through the heavens. He has gone into the very presence of God. The picture of the Old Testament has now been done away with. I think in chapter 9, verse 24, you find there as well that there's a reference to this, but it says like this, for Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, that is the physical, visible holy place, which are copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. This is what he has done on our behalf. He is there now in the presence of God on your behalf and my behalf. He has entered into the very courts of heaven itself. He has gone with that precious blood, the blood of the everlasting covenant. He has sealed our eternal redemption through his blood. But the wonderful thing is that he is there now in the courts of heaven on your behalf and my behalf. He speaks to God in our favor, presents us before God. He is the Son of God, and we have become the children of God. He has ushered us in. The veil of the temple was torn in two. The way into the holiest has now been made possible. You and I have the ability to come before God. We have the ability to come to this throne of grace. We have the ability to come into the very presence of God. There is access for us. There is the opportunity for us, each and every one of us, to be able to come before him. But the thing about Jesus is, isn't it? It's great to see his role and his function as our great high priest. But what a description we have of him, you know, his character, his humanity, the fact of what kind of person is he? We read about him, we don't have a high priest who cannot be touched or is not sympathetic to our situation, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Here is one who is very, very sympathetic to our situation. He understands us through his own experience. He knows what we are going through. He has gone through it himself. He was tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. So we have one who has demonstrated to us the kind of person that he is. We look back and we read, don't we, in the Gospels about Jesus. And the wonderful thing is that when you read about Jesus there, and you see the events that he, you know, performed, the people that he spoke to, the way in which he encouraged them, the mercy, the kindness, the goodness that he was showing to these particular people. And yet on top of all of that, isn't it, how sympathetic he was to the plight of man. You know, when he comes to the grave of Lazarus, it just tells us that Jesus wept. Now in that weeping, you know, we can see here one who was sympathetic to the plight of man. He sees here the final fulfillment and the effect of sin upon man, that the wages of sin is death, and here was death before him. And yet, who was so moved that it just tells us that he wept at the tomb of Lazarus, even though he knew full well that he was about to raise him up from the dead? He said to Martha, didn't he, that he was sleeping. There was a time coming when Jesus was going to go and summon him from death to life. This was not the end, the terminal situation of this man Lazarus. He was going to be raised from the dead. He was going to glorify Jesus. And the fact of the power of this resurrection was going to be manifested. Jesus was going to be able to do this and raise this man up from the dead. And so we find him there, don't we? Or you can think of John chapter 21, for example, you know, Jesus dealing with Peter. Peter had denied Jesus three times. Peter was self-confident. He was boasting of the fact that if everybody denied you, yet I would never do it, you know. And we all a bit like that sometimes, you know. Everybody else, yeah, but me, never, you know. We don't know ourselves sometimes. And Peter didn't know himself. But when Jesus comes to him, isn't it? You know, you can feel the pathos in John chapter 21, can't you, where Jesus is there. They're out fishing. Jesus is cooking this fish. They turn around, they see Jesus on the sand there, as it were, on the bank of the sea. And, you know, he's on the beach at that moment of time. And here he is, he's cooking these fish. And then all of a sudden there's this reconciliation and recognition of who Jesus is. Suddenly they realize this is Jesus. Why? Jesus has said to them, you know, have you caught anything? And they said, no, we haven't caught anything. They said, well, you know, well, cast your net on the other side and see what you catch. And when they threw the net on the other side, of course, they catch a massive fish. And this was a reminder, wasn't it, of another event in the life of Jesus when he had done exactly the same thing. And then John turns to Peter and he says, it's the Lord. It's the Lord. You know, and Peter, his enthusiasm, isn't it? You know, God puts something over him. He had stripped off because he was fishing at the moment of time. He puts something on, dives into the water, goes out to see Jesus. When he comes before Jesus, Jesus speaks with him, doesn't he? And the way in which he handles him, isn't it? It's so sympathetic to Peter's situation. Here was a man who had been crushed, basically. Crushed because of his denial of Jesus. Crushed because of his conscience. Crushed because he felt unworthy of Jesus at that moment of time. And yet for all of that, deep down in the heart of Peter, he continued to love Jesus. And so you find that Jesus tenderly deals with him in this particular way, isn't it? Peter, do you love me? You know, and he goes through the scenario, doesn't he? And he reinstates him basically as a shepherd of the sheep. He reinstates him back to that place and back to that position whereby he had fallen by his sin, or so he felt he had fallen by his sin. But you have this with Jesus, isn't it? Now when we come to the throne of grace, we're coming to one, you know, who is sympathetic to us. There is one who he looks upon us and he feels for us. He is who? He is our elder brother. He is the one who loved us and gave himself for us. It tells us, doesn't it, in John chapter 14, verse 1, you know, it tells us there, isn't it, that Jesus loved his own unto the end. There is never a time when Jesus ceases to love his people. There is never a time when he is not concerned for them. He is absolutely concerned for them in every situation. He feels for them, even though he's there in the very courts of heaven itself. There is this sympathy. that flows from heaven to us in this world with all the tragedies and the difficulties and the crises that we are going through. We are unlike the world. We have one who is sympathetic to our situation. One who is there in the presence of God for us. One who is pleading for our situation. But you see, we come, don't we, to this throne of grace. And the term grace there defines what kind of throne it is, isn't it? It's not a throne of judgment, it's a throne of grace. The person sitting upon it is infinitely gracious. Infinitely gracious. The way in which he will deal with us. How is he going to deal with us? He cannot do anything that is contrary to his own nature. And as a gracious God, how would he do anything else other than be gracious to us? We can find grace to help in time of need as we come before the before this throne of God. When you think of thrones at one time, isn't it? A king would sit upon a throne. And when we are dealing with this throne of grace, of course, we're dealing with the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. But kings at one time, you know, they had the power of life and death. You know, people, when they used to come before them, used to crawl before them. They'd be on their hands and knees. They would do obeisance to them. They would bow down before them. They would be in fear and trepidation as they came before them. But we are not to come like that. We are told we are to come with confidence. We are to come with boldness. Why? Because we've got not only one eye upon the throne of grace, but we've got another eye upon Jesus himself. Here is the representative. Here is our advocate. Here is the one who ever lives to make intercession for us. Our great high priest is there with us at that moment of time. We are pleading at the throne of grace, but he is there. And when God looks upon us, he has an eye for Jesus as well. Because Jesus himself has rescued us and bought us and brought us into the very presence of God. Donald Trump. Sorry to mention this, Dancy and Colleen, but Donald Trump was put in his place this week, wasn't he? One Democrat got up and said, "We do not have kings. We are a republic." And he was put in his place soundly at that moment of time to show that he was not sovereign. He was not in charge of everything, though he thinks he might be, but he is not in charge of everything. And poor old Donald was put in his place, and so it went, isn't it? But the whole point is this, isn't it? The emphasis was this man saw that kings had absolute power. Our king has absolute power. We have a king who's Lord over all. We have a king who is sovereign in every way. You know, you think back about Nebuchadnezzar, rather. You know, when you go back into the Old Testament, in the book of Daniel, and in chapter 4 of that particular chapter, you get Nebuchadnezzar really relating the second dream that he has to Daniel. And as he is relating this particular dream to Daniel, he is giving a picture there of, he dreamt this dream, he had sleepless nights, he didn't know what to do with himself, you know. And he concludes like this, on verse 17 of chapter 4, he says, "This decision is by the decree of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar," that is Daniel, of course, "declare its interpretation, since all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation. But you are able, for the Spirit of the Holy God is in you." And then, of course, Daniel gives him the interpretation, which wasn't in his favor, really. He was going to go crackers and, you know, he was going to go off his head and, you know, that being the case, isn't it? But the wonderful thing is that God was going to restore him. And God was going to humble him in this way. And it's wonderful to see Nebuchadnezzar's response a little later on. And it says like this, let me just read to you these particular words in verse 34. "And at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven. And among the inhabitants of the earth, no one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? What is it saying to us? Here was the man who was the most powerful man in the world. He had absolute power. And yet, for all of that, doesn't it, God humbled him. And he came to realize that there was this living God. There was this God who rules in an absolute sense. He rules over the kingdom and nations. He rules over all the powers that be. Even I, Nebuchadnezzar, recognize now that there is this God in heaven. There is this God who has infinite power. And he does whatever he likes, and none can say to him, what are you doing? Why? Because he is sovereign over all. And so when we come, isn't it? When we come to this throne of grace to ask God for blessings and for favors, we should always remember, shouldn't we, that we have one in the very presence of God pleading our cause. It was such a privilege for people, you know, to have an advocate with kings. People would pay great sums of money to have advocates with kings. Could buy them great privileges, put them in high positions, places of authority and power, and make them very wealthy and rich. And they used to come with tokens to give to kings and purchase these blessings and benefits. But it's not like that with us, is it? We don't come with anything that to give unto God. We simply come because Jesus has opened up that way. He's made it possible for us that we can come before God. God is such a wonderful God that he himself is asking us to come. He has sent his son to make it possible for us to come. And if we are to have confidence in God, is to realize, isn't it, that when we come before God, it's because there is a place whereby we can find mercy and find help in time of need, isn't it? We can find that grace that God will bestow upon us to help us through all the crises, all the difficulties. You know, we're in the same boat as the rest of the world at this moment of time with the coronavirus and all that. But our eye isn't upon the world. It isn't upon politicians. It isn't upon those with power. But our eye is upon God. We believe in a sovereign God who acts sovereignly in all the things that he does. And our confidence, our absolute confidence, is in a God who bids us come. And when we feel strained and stressed and anxious about anything, it is to come before this God who will dispense grace to us. I'm not going to go into how he dispenses grace to us, but just to tell you that he does do it. And he gives us grace to help us in our hour of need. So let's come before God tonight in prayer, isn't it, and treat him, attack, as it were, the very throne of grace, beseech God that he would hear and answer the prayers of his people. Bless us and encourage us as the people of God.